It's the Anti-Lon Chaney Award. In honor of the darkest hour, what's the worst movie makeup?
I'm Katie Rich, and of the many horrible things about Clint Eastwood's J. Edgar, I will never forget the sight of poor Armie Hammer entombed in latex to play old whoever he was playing.
Is it me? Mm-hmm. I'm Matt Patches, and I am going to go with Dan Aykroyd in the 1991 horrible, horrible movie Nothing But Trouble, where he dresses up like part... who's the guy from A Christmas Carol? Scrooge? He's part Scrooge, part like butt boil or something. It's disgusting.
And it's me, David the Seven, who says Michael J. Fox as Marty's future daughter in Back to the Future, Part 2. It's not on screen long enough to be really disturbing, but once you notice it, it is disturbing.
And I'm David Ehrlich, and you know what? Fuck it. I'm going to go with Kevin Spacey as J. Paul Getty in All the Money in the World, because honestly, they should have fucking replaced him in that movie anyway. Every shot of him in the old age makeup in the trailer was so deeply distracting that poor choices all around.
Gentlemen, you can't fight in here. This is the war room.
Fine, I can hear you now, Dimitri. Clear and plain and coming through fine. I'm coming through fine too, eh? Good. Then, well then, as you say, we're both coming through fine. Good. Well, it's good that you're fine then, and I'm fine. I agree with you. It's great to be fine.
It's a podcast. Hello and welcome to Fighting in the War Room. It's episode 191, and it's Tuesday, November 21st, and on this date in 1976, Rocky premiered in New York and Los Angeles. That's a good anniversary. Dave had a hard time coming up with good things that happened today, so I'm glad we really powered through.
Yeah, I think it just premiered in New York. I think that New York and Los Angeles was a remnant from Network, which opened last Fighting in the War Room anniversary.
Oh, God, yeah. Good period for 70s movies, I guess. Before we get started, I believe we have at least some reviews from an entirely different country as tipped off by a Twitter user. David, what do we got?
Oi! We have some reviews from Down Under.
Oh, boy.
you have to understand that my Australian accent is actually not an accent, but rather an impression of what's-his-face from Funny People. Help me out here.
Eric Bana,
yeah. nothing but love for Australia and your giant snakes and spiders and Margot Robbie's. But Eric Bana as a cartoon of an Australian man in Funny People, it's just burned into my brain. But we have a lovely review from Aaron in Oz. Oi, listen to this podcast. I can't, you know what, I just can't do it in real time.
Yeah, don't do
it.
They're going to stop listening.
I know. In the privacy of my own home, in my cone of silence, I can do a perfect Australian accent.
You'll be the third top of the lake in this. No.
Exactly. I've been cast. Don't tell anyone.
By the end of this.
They needed someone else to continue reviewing the show ecstatically after the second one was got such a mixed reaction. But Aaron in Oz says, listen to this podcast. It's the Carol of all podcasts. That means that it's the best. I mean, I can't, because of iTunes restrictions, officially say that this review was helpful, but we all know that it was. And
we need a new Carol. I'm just going to put it out there.
We could all rally behind Lady Bird as a foursome.
I was just going to say,
as much
I
as
feel
having
like
a foursome with you all about Lady Bird sounds
and Saoirse Ronan
delightful. Let's not, Katie, please. We're trying to keep us aboard.
Keep really far out of this.
But Saoirse Ronan is an angel, and I will not have you besmirch her good name. Lady Bird is definitely a contender for a repeat Carol, but I think, you know, the thing about Carol is that you don't simply get one every year, or really even every 3 years. It cannot be faked. It cannot be, your enthusiasm cannot be inflated. It has to be so profound and soul-stirring that you have to talk about it ad nauseum, no matter how much it annoys strangers on the internet for years at a time. Which is not,
I think,
to say
it's because
that it annoys,
of how much it annoys strangers on the internet.
Not for me. Which is not to say that it annoys Aaron, who I believe is a big Carol fan.
I thought the Asylum knockoff of Carol, Coral, was pretty good.
But I, you know, the problem was also World of Tomorrow, I think, was Carol level for me, and it arrived at the same time. And now I have World of Tomorrow sequel, which just really continues the same thing, but a whole new Carol. Lady Bird definitely comes close. But
thank you to everyone in Australia and anywhere else who's leaving reviews. And please keep tipping us off about foreign iTunes stores. It's fun to hear from you and then fun to read those reviews. And David will only do accents if you ask. We are an accent consent heavy podcast around here. It's the dream.
This week, or I guess last week, because this week we're dealing with the first weekend box office numbers, we finally got to see Zack Snyder's Justice League, the conclusion of his retroactively named trilogy, or claimed trilogy, to kick off the DC extended universe. But unfortunately, Snyder was unable to finish his film because of a personal tragedy. He and the producer, Deborah Snyder, had to step off, bringing Joss Whedon in to finish the film. Justice League is out. It is not very good. It made less than $100 million over the weekend, and everybody is yelling doom for the DC cinematic universe. I think everybody on this podcast, besides Katie, has seen Justice. Katie, did you make time to see Justice League?
No, it sure didn't. I've been watching the Crown screeners. It's basically the same.
I mean,
not a word from you on the show, on the Crown. I refuse. My wife, as well, I give her credit for her patience because I don't have any, refuses to watch the Crown screeners because they're watermarked, and the Crown must be.
I think that's totally valid.
And so we refuse to watch them until December 8th.
Well, David, I don't want to drop any spoilers on you, but Philip and Elizabeth did have their 70th anniversary today as we record this. So,
What did I just say, Katie?
David, as we discussed on this podcast, historical beats, especially any attacks by Steppenwolf during UK history, are not spoilers. So, get over yourself.
So Dave has Justice League.
Not a good movie. It's one of my favorite of the DC Cinematic Universe movies because Batman smiles and Flash makes jokes and Aquaman.
Wait, you
a
like
bro.
It better than Wonder Woman?
Oh no, I'm sorry. I guess Wonder Woman is my favorite. I put that off to a separate category because it doesn't have all of these things that the rest of the movies have to deal with. Like Batman v Superman doesn't manage to be its own movie. Suicide Squad has to bring in Batman and then therefore also doesn't get to be its own movie. And then, now Justice League is supposed to be the conclusion of all these threads, but at somewhere along the line decided it wasn't going to do that and instead was going to do its own thing with its self-contained villain and bring Superman back and get out in under 2 hours. So it's really short and very slight. It feels like a patchwork Frankenstein of two different movies, neither of which had either the support or the people behind it to execute what it thought it wanted to. And what we're left with is this like interesting curio. But in the world of dark superheroes or happy superheroes and nonsense plots, as a fan of like animated superhero television, I didn't hate Justice League like I hated Batman v Superman and like I grew to hate Suicide Squad. David.
That Justice League is less hateable than any of the more ambitious films in the DCEU. That E really bothers me.
Hearing you say
that bothers me most about the DCEU. But yeah, I mean, Justice League is, as Dave said, it's shorn to the bone. It is a purely utilitarian movie. It has nothing on its mind but assembling the team and laying the foundation for a more stable cinematic universe. And
it's kind of like one of the MP4s Batman might watch in his off time to learn about other superheroes.
Yes,
more
yes,
than it is a movie.
Yes. It could have been something that he watched, in the future, looking back and remembering how he got there. I don't know, but it doesn't take anything remotely resembling the risks that Man of Steel, which is a risible film, and Batman vs. Superman, which I think is actually a better movie, if only because it falls on its face harder, tries more things. The opening segment, I think, is a brilliant answer to the biggest criticisms of Man of Steel, and maybe means that some people were rushing to judgment about the whole collateral damage thing. But that's another conversation for another time. Those movies, as much as many people understandably, deservedly hate them, at least are going for something. Justice League is just trying to stitch an old wound that has already started to rot, and it is doing it and we're trying to break a speed record, which is not exactly what you want out of a surgeon. And it's a hot mess. But Wonder Woman is such a bright spot, you know, just in general for this franchise, that even if the franchise is in trouble, she is Teflon. And I think that, you know, it will feel, the biggest problem that DC has right now is it's going to feel like the Wonder Woman cinematic universe, with the rest of the DC characters just sort of gasping for air and waiting to be graced with her presence.
Are they gasping for air because they're Aquaman and they belong in the sea?
Hey-o.
Yes, they are.
They actually,
this is what I'm here for.
Aquaman does need to create bubbles in order to speak English underwater. It should be.
There's going to be a whole movie about that next year.
I can't wait to see a whole movie where they all have to be like blowing big bubbles and quickly monologuing.
Yeah, I mean, I don't
I'll
know.
See that. Dave,
what did you guys think about, because this movie, very obviously, and they're not shy about this, they're not ashamed of it, pulls from the Marvel playbook. I mean, not just a page or two, but entire chapters.
The opening of the movie is a video of Spider-Man, like, fake filmed on an iPhone.
Superman.
That's
Superman.
Ripping. Oh, sorry, Superman. That's ripping.
Spider-Man had been in this movie.
No, no.
It's ripping
Spider-Man. Yes. That's my confusion here. That it's directly the opening of Spider-Man: Homecoming. It's insane how by the book or by the Marvel book that this movie would be.
I have a hard time imagining that they were able to cobble that together. I know those
really
reshoots, but I don't know how
the whole movie is cobbled together last minute. I feel like they were doing. Dave, tell me if this is true or not, that they were doing reshoots during the summer for this movie. That it's entirely possible that they could do a scene like this on the fly.
I guess so. Yeah.
Crazy.
It is Frankenstein together. And if only Frankenstein could have been the monster instead of Steppenwolf, we probably would have had a much better film on our hands. The lack of stakes is staggering. Anyway, I was talking about Marvel and how they rip off Marvel. And it made me think, in a way, I mean, this is the last thing that DC is going for, but it's flattering to Marvel because it makes me, who's so tired of sort of the Marvel formula, think that it is actually harder to pull off than it might appear at this point, where they've fallen into a rhythm and it seems somewhat effortless. When you see someone try to fake it without the necessary components, it feels so strained, and you just, I don't know.
It's not necessary components, because I think they have charismatic actors cast in these roles. I even think Khal Drogo, what is his name? Jason Momoa as Aquaman could potentially lead a decent Aquaman movie with his kind of gruff Icelander kind of. I don't know. I like that shtick that he brings to the table. And I even like, you know, none of the characters of this movie have backstories, even though they go, you know, cyborg. God, what happened to him? He like blew up in a fire and they rebuilt him with alien technology. Kryptonian technology.
It was a car crash, but
I thought the lab exploded.
No. They talk about a car crash. He's in a car crash and then his dad used the mother box to bring him back.
Well, I guess who cares is the answer to that, but
is Cyborg inextricable from the Justice League? Is there not any means by which they could have found a character that is not 95% CG and 100% awful?
Hawkman, Hawkwoman?
No, and that's part of what's frustrating about the DC cinematic universe as a whole, is that Marvel's been at it longer, but they've been doing things like taking Guardians of the Galaxy and Doctor Strange and introducing them to people.
Yes, that's what.
And having a lot more success than DC, which literally has access to any of its characters, but keeps coming back and ruining like tentpole ones and polluting the water, so that, you know, like even if they were to go do a you know, the incredible Plastic Man movie, like, people would have to struggle to care at this point, because if you can't get Batman right, what sort of faith are we going to give you to get Plastic Man right?
It's like IP deforestation, right? We can't slowly take resources from the land and then replant and take our time. They have to wipe out an entire forest. They have to build the biggest enterprise that they can right off the bat. There's no introductory movies. We're way behind the Marvel plan, and now we have to play catch up. The whole movie lives in the shadow of the MCU, and for the worse, right? I don't see why they need to rush. Couldn't we still have an Aquaman movie? I mean, a Wonder Woman movie proves that you could have slowly
and
done
fundamentally,
this.
The, putting the cart before the horse like this, having the team movie before you make the movies of the individual people that allow us to be invested in the characters is a huge mistake. And you can understand the imperative that they had to get to this point, and they were hoping to sort of reverse engineer our interest in this greater superhero team. But even though I didn't particularly like Iron Man, I didn't particularly like the movie, I didn't particularly like the original Captain America, I certainly didn't particularly like the original Thor. By the time they all get together, the Avengers, I understand their dynamic. I know a little bit about them. I'm a little bit more invested just because of the time that I put into who they are. And I get at a deeper level, as if I had been reading the comics or some of the comics, what's funny about their dynamic, what's conflicted about it, and so on. And here it's like, Cyborg, I'm here, I'm plastic, thrown into this movie, go. And it's like and then he just disappears for half the time. It's absolutely impossible for someone to care about him in this movie. I challenge anyone. It is.
I mean, I like the actor though. That's where I was going.
The
I think the casting is kind of aces. He's doing this old Will Smith impression, and I love his lines. I love his brooding. He could, you know, he could be in a movie, in a functional movie, but it's kind of like picking up with The Office in season 5 or something. You're so far ahead. There's no groundwork for these movies. They're not, and that's why I didn't think they were funny either. A lot of the patchworking that you're talking about is kind of filling the holes with jokes and kind of this friendly dynamic, but it doesn't feel authentic at all. These people have never met. They don't care for each other, and then all of a sudden they do, because they don't need motivation to get anywhere. They just go from point A to point B to point C, and they're making wisecracks, but like, you want to do that with friends, right? I think that's why Joss Whedon got away with it. You set up, I mean, the beginning of the Avengers movie is not good, right? Can we?
That whole escape.
Am I remembering correctly? Like, everything before the Battle of New York? Is that good?
No,
I really can't remember.
No, there's good. There's the helicarrier thing and
where they're really butting heads for the first time, right?
Yeah, no, but it's really just the first 20 minutes or so where they're stealing the Infinity Stone. That's sort of lame.
I guess maybe that's my big question. What makes the Avengers work that Justice League fails so hard? Because I think they're both. I think Justice League's problem. I was telling someone the other day that it's interesting to me that Joss Whedon and Jon Favreau, director, and J.J. Abrams they're like top tier blockbuster directors, right? But they also have all directed episodes of The Office. And I don't think this is a coincidence. I think it's like these guys step in and make TV. And in this case, they stepped in and made franchise installments working for showrunners, i.e., the producers, or ED producers. And this is what the DCU is actually missing. It's missing the showrunners. It's too director invested. Zack Snyder was a director. As you were saying, David, Batman versus Superman is like a real movie. People are making choices. They might be the bad choices, but like, that is his movie, his vision, his weird, dark, misguided vision. And Justice League is corporate crap, but at least, you know, it's so much flatter. It's so less offensive than Batman v Superman, and I was lacking it at the end. I wanted to like be pissed off. I wanted to have the headache I had at the end of Batman v Superman just to like feel something at the end of Justice
League.
It's such a blah movie.
In the moment, but it's more offensive in reflection because you realize the extent to which you were pandered to.
Right.
It's
bad television.
Just, like, how empty the whole experience was.
It's bad TV.
Yeah. It's bad everything.
But
not bad everything. We're going to learn some interesting things from this movie when, you know, WB shakes off this weekend. and the buzz around it and figures out, you know, what's going to happen with it. And I think that there's
so good on the whole learning front.
Well, see, that's the thing. Every movie has been like slightly a reaction to what the last movie was, to the point that, you know, the good sequences in Batman v Superman are addressing the critics. And then this one entirely, it's like they saw a Zack Snyder cut and they're like, no, we're just going to entirely bend to what people told us they wanted in Batman v Superman and, you know, sort of corner it into Justice League. But that like erases everything that came before it. I'm interested to see if any lessons come out of this, because you keep thinking that the lesson's going to be the studio is going to learn not to screw with the movie, but that doesn't keep happening.
So inspired by a Twitter thread that I responded to, I don't remember if anyone else on this did. And as David, I know, is preparing to vote with the New York Film Critics Circle, and Patches and I are getting our Broadcast Film Critics Association screeners. And Dave, do you have screeners piling up? Or are you just?
I don't get screeners because I'm not part of a critics circle. I'm just your everyday asshole with internet opinions.
Well, you have opinions then on performances that you feel like are not going to get awards attention, but you think deserve it, which is maybe our little mini version of a For Your Consideration campaign, or just things you can tell people to catch up with. Patches, you wanted to do this one, so what do you have in mind?
Oh, God. Well, I guess I have a few things. I just caught up with Stronger, a movie I don't think we talked about at all on the podcast, and it really came and went after Toronto. I think it premiered in Toronto and then came out just like 2 weeks after or something. This is this is a film by David Gordon Green, starring Jake Gyllenhaal as a fella named Jeff Bauman, who was unfortunately at the finish line of the Boston Marathon when that bomb went off a few years ago, and he lost his legs. And unlike Patriots game, Patriots Day, the Tom Clancy adaptation of the Boston bombing. Yeah. No, unlike that Mark Wahlberg thriller, which was really a manhunt movie, Stronger is all about the aftermath of this event for Jeff and his rehabilitation and his struggles with his family and making ends meet and having this relationship with his kind of on-again, off-again girlfriend Erin, played by Tatiana Maslany from Orphan Black. And everyone obviously rushes to his side to be really supportive and help him get off the ground and kind of come back to life. But it's very difficult because everyone wants him to be a hero. Everyone wants him to be a victim who can rise up and be a symbol. You know, Boston Strong is being shouted
and
in every direction around him.
One important detail is that when he is just arriving in the hospital and he's like on the brink of death and his two legs have just been blown off.
Oh, he alerts the authorities
that he saw the bomber.
Right, that's
and
true.
And he points him in the right direction. So he does do something heroic.
Yeah, he is a hero. He is a hero. But what does it mean to be a hero in these kind of hypermedia times? And that's really what Stronger gets at. And I found it pretty fascinating. It can be a little saccharine at times with, you know, Jake Gyllenhaal giving this performance where he doesn't use his legs. And it's obviously a very physical thing for him. But I was just kind of blown away by the people in his orbit. I really think this is Tatiana Maslany's movie as much as Gyllenhaal's, just being this woman put in this precarious position where she doesn't actually want to like be with him, really, at least in the beginning of the movie. She's broken up with him several times, but she feels compelled to come back. He's begging her to be by his side as he rehabilitates, and she kind of gives in, and she is going to be the one who's like dragging his wheelchair up and down the stairs and like giving him sponge baths and dealing with his horrendous mother, who's played incredibly by Miranda Richardson. And it's like, I had to look her up. I couldn't believe it was her playing his Boston mom. It was just a phenomenal performance. And this is the most Boston movie since The Town,
I would say. But I think, you know, that's what you're getting at is also that the movie is very much about, you know, being a hero in these media times, but what happens when all the cameras go away and you're just left to live your life? and that like profound sense of isolation and loneliness. There's this great scene where he goes to a Boston Bruins game to go up for the national anthem and has to break down the elevator. And I would cry too if I had to go to a Boston Bruins playoff game when they weren't playing the Rangers.
Yeah.
But so I get where he's coming from. But he's but I think it's so much of what it hones in on his relationship with her and how she is going to have to care for him and what she needs from him. And just that, like, the feeling of the tide going out when everyone's attention recedes and he's still left in this condition. It's hard to watch, but I think it's very effectively done.
And so I guess if I had to point anyone out to voters, it would be, I mean, I think Jake Gyllenhaal is very good in the movie, and his kind of PTSD episodes are really moving. But I was really struck by Tatiana Maslany, who is dealing with her own issues here, and it's a very, and she struggles to accept that those could be issues, or that she deserves to live and thrive in the aftermath of this event too. So I would really give a shout out to her. And I guess very quickly,
did you know that they broke up in real life?
Well, they broke up, but she got pregnant and had a kid.
Yeah, no, they have a kid, and then they broke up.
It's the ending of the movie is a little strange because they kind of like gloss over some of those details, but they're definitely not together. I was debating with someone if in the end of the movie if they're together.
No, they definitely are.
They're together in the end?
That was the implication that I got.
Oh, I thought she was like in another room. I don't want to spoil.
Because they broke up like after the film wrapped.
Right. Yeah, later in life. But
it's a tough movie to end because the whole point of it is that this is their life now.
There's no end, right.
And exactly. That it goes on before we can see it. And so David Gordon Green sort of runs out of runway, and it's just sort of like, it's over. But it's very good. Katie, is there someone you wanted to shout out?
Yeah, I feel like I have a long list of people, and the person I tweeted is not the person I'm going to say because it was Haley Lou Richardson in Columbus, which we've talked about recently. Yep. But I can't remember if we talked about Lost City of Z in too much detail, which is a movie I loved this movie when I saw it earlier this year. And Charlie Hunnam, who I have never liked in literally anything, is amazing in this movie. He's the lead character. He plays this explorer, Percy Fawcett. It's this movie by James Gray, and it's very macho and about the wilderness and man versus nature. And he's incredible in it. And I think it's definitely on Amazon now. So very easy to watch. Not an easy watch, I would say, but I think really worth it, especially get it on like the biggest screen with like the blackest blacks you can, because it's beautifully shot. I was really glad I saw it on the big screen, but it's accessible to everyone now. And everyone
it goes so many places.
It goes in a lot of places. It's just when you think it's over, it goes to World War One and the trenches.
That's what I'm thinking of. Like the beauty of the jungle is what gets a lot of the attention, or at least the press when it came out a few months ago. But the World War One scenes are quite...
There, weird, big year for World War One. I mean, it's got like Tom Holland, who is Spider-Man, is in it for a while, which is, I mean, it's kind of such a big cast, you almost don't notice he's in there for a minute. And it's got like all those darkest hour scenes of white British men yelling at each other in rooms, but better, I think. But Charlie Hunnam would be the person who I would really push for, who I don't think is going to get the attention he deserves.
I feel like Haley Lou Richardson is a great pick, and we've gone to bat for her. I feel like I've gone to bat exhaustively for Kristen Stewart in Personal Shopper. So I will go with Cynthia Nixon in A Quiet Passion as Emily Dickinson in Terrence Davies' very claustrophobic biopic that plays more like a simulation of Emily Dickinson's life rather than a traditional biopic. It is almost non-narrative in its plotting. It takes place as Emily Dickinson's life did, almost entirely in her house. It's very contained. It's very morbid and focused on death and her lack of a romantic life and whether or not she wanted one, her own feelings about her own sort of beauty and self-esteem. And it gets into her poetry in a very sort of like through the skin rather than... in a more emotionally direct way. It's very affecting in its own way. It's a very strange performance. It's unlike anything else that I've seen recently. It reminded me a little bit more of like a Robert Bresson film or something like that. It's not what you see in screen acting these days, really, at all. But it's a lot more emotionally driven than like a Robert Bresson character would be, but still with that sort of distance and lack of affect. I think it's really fascinating. It's a fascinating movie. A lot of people would be really turned off by it, but it has definitely stuck with me. And a quick shout out also to Florence Pew, I want to say.
Sounds right.
Lady Macbeth. Lady Macbeth.
Is that movie seeable anywhere? I feel like it came and went for me, and now I have no idea where it is.
I feel like not quite yet, but it will be soon, and you'll hear people who saw it make a big deal about that. It is nothing to do with Shakespeare. It is sort of it's a period piece about a woman who is in a marriage that she does not want to be in, and she has an affair that ends great. it's one of those, but it's done with such energy and such rage, and I think people will not have a difficult time connecting it with what the state of the world right now. But it's really ferocious and well done. The first-time filmmaker whose name escapes me right now, but that might be on some year-end lists, just saying.
And Dave, how about you?
She's working with Park Chan-wook now in his first series. And the movie sort of reminded me a lot of Park Chan-wook, and her performance in it could have slipped into any one of his movies, certainly The Housemaid. So, cool.
Dave?
I haven't seen the majority of the things you guys are recommending, but if I did have to pick somebody that leapt out at me because of their performance and because I'd never seen them before, I would pick somebody whose name I'm probably going to murder. Garance Marillier, the lead girl in Raw, premiered in Toronto, female-directed horror movie about a vegetarian student who's studying veterinary science in college. She gets hazed by eating a kidney of a rabbit that leads her slowly to cannibalism. And it stays intense while also vulnerable, because that's what the metaphor demands of it. And it's on Netflix, if you are like me and don't have access to some of these performances yet.
Dave, without spoiling, yay or nay, what did you think of the last scene of that movie?
I think yay, but I think yay about a lot of crazy things.
I thought it was just like, I don't know. I liked that they went there with it, but I wanted it to go deeper, and I also sort of saw that coming, and it didn't hit with the same force that I wanted it to. But it's a cool movie.
Yeah, I don't think it's a tour de force horror movie as much as it's a good performance in a pretty decent debut as far as horror movies go.
What we were just talking about with things that we like that are available for you to watch. But we're heading into Thanksgiving weekend here in the United States, where a lot of us will be spending time with our families. And in many years for me, and I think this is for a lot of us at certain points, you're all stuck in the house together and you need something to watch. I really vividly remember a year when Lady Gaga had like a special on NBC, and I wound up watching it with my in-laws, none of whom I think cared that much about Lady Gaga, but it was what was on, so it was what we watched. So, I mean, maybe before we start recommending specific things and, you know, what's either in theaters or at home, like, do you guys do this? Do you get stuck in your house and try to think of, like, what that you know is on Netflix you can get your parents to like?
That occasionally happens to me. This year, my family's going to be, like, all sort of spread around, so for the first time, I've been squirreling away things like Mastermind on Netflix just to, you know, feed that part of my brain.
So stuff just for yourself.
Exactly. But what I did get to discuss with my parents when I was visiting with them this weekend is how much that they are interested in trying American Vandal after listening to our podcast about it.
Oh.
And how they would really just like me to be there for their start of it.
But Katie, do your parents listen to this podcast? Or is my mom no. one of her parents that doesn't?
No, my parents definitely do not listen to this podcast.
Oh, no. Liz is listening to this right now. Hi, Liz.
Hi, Liz.
Hi.
Hey.
Hi, Rod Patches, also.
Parents, but yeah, I think that's been interesting because what I would usually choose is something like non-offensive off of the idea that family time is supposed to be as generic as possible, especially Thanksgiving, especially in this climate. You know, you don't want to press any buttons, but Who Drew the Dicks seems to be how low the bar is these days for adult media conversation. And I thought that was interesting in this year of our Lord, 2017.
Do you have teachers in your family?
Do what?
Do you have teachers in your family?
We don't.
Because I'm like my mom and sister are both teachers, and I'm trying to think if they would find it funny or not. Like if it would be too. Neither of them have ever taught high school, so I don't know. It's like a funny connection to it that I don't have that they might.
Yeah, I guess we're gonna do that. Or sometime around Thanksgiving when they get back. And then, of course, also while my mom's listening, for those of us that are into our continuing superhero shows on the CW, I get to catch up with that with my mom at some point and Star Trek Discovery with my dad at some point. So we're like...
You're going to be busy.
We're taking all the TV and sort of like condensing it so we could get together and sort of like finding a way to binge watch... But it becomes like a focus time. So I don't feel like I'm really answering your question because what you're talking about is like an escapism for the whole family. And I'm talking about my family's made holidays condensed media digestion time.
I think a lot of families do, though. And I think it's like this is what's interesting is everyone is different. Like depending on who you're with in a given year, like you might, you know, one Christmas one year we all watched my screener of The Revenant. And that was like the holiday viewing for the family, which is not what most people would do.
yeah, my family just does not watch things together. We all go our separate ways at home. I mean, I would like to go to a movie with them because the last time we all went to a movie together was to see The Force Awakens, and
good
that was,
family outing.
Yeah, I mean, it was a fun context for me to watch my mom, who is a 70-year-old woman who I just don't think of in that way as watching a Star Wars movie. I mean, my mom is sort of a closet Trekkie, but like I'm just not privy to that part of her, so that was cool. And then after my dad died, I picked The Intern to watch. It was the last movie we watched as like a family at home, and that was a bad choice.
Yeah.
I was like, all right, well, family viewing time might be over.
Maybe this year is the year for home again, just like get back on that Nancy Meyers train.
Unless they're gonna send me an Oscar screener for Home Again if they're feeling really ambitious. Well, we're going to talk about the movies that are... Well, this is a segment all about service journalism, is it not? About telling people, kind of like our mini-segment there, what
kind
people
of.
Should be watching with their families.
Well, I think... So, Patches and I both wanted to talk about Mudbound, which is probably the newest big movie on Netflix. It debuted last weekend, and it does seem like something where it's like, okay, it's a big epic. It's got history to it. It's got a bunch of movie stars in it. Like, maybe this is something that you watch with other people. Having literally just finished watching it, I don't know. I think it's a big gamble to watch with your family.
Why?
Patches. I mean, I don't want to spoil anything, but it gets dark. You have to have, like, the people who are kind of up for some tough truths about America's racial
past. It's about racism in America, yeah. And World War II.
Yeah, like every conversation you're going to have around the Thanksgiving table, it's about racism in America. So it'll fit right into the spirit of the holiday, certainly in the spirit of the holiday in 2017. But it is not a Netflix movie.
No.
I saw it at Sundance, and I was impressed by it, but unmoved in a way. I found the filmmaking just not to my taste, but the characters are really well drawn, and it obviously courses with so much vital history to it and pathos. But I tried watching it again today on Netflix, and it's up on Netflix. Anyone can go see it there. And it just, like, I could not get back into it. And I think a large part of it is just because, like, it just is not a movie that does well when you have any other distraction. It is a big...
Yeah, I mean, it's got, like, beautiful vistas and sunsets and kind of, like, quiet moments between people where you kind of have to watch to see what's going on. And a lot of like emotions that aren't being said. And, you know, that applies to The Crown, which is something we've all watched on Netflix and really enjoyed. But there is something about it that it feels expansive in a way that you might rather see it on a big screen. But I mean, I watched it on Netflix. I enjoyed it. I feel like I got a lot out of it. And like Dave was saying earlier, like when you're not in a place where these things are available to you, I think Mudbound's on 17 screens somewhere in the country. So that opens it up to all of people like us who wouldn't have been able to see it otherwise, which I'm glad I did see it.
If you're going to watch Mudbound on Netflix, it's definitely one. I mean, the best advice that I can give you for it is just that it's one where you don't want to have anything else open on your screen. You want to put it on the television if that's an option, rather than on your iPad or phone or computer, and turn down the lights and give yourself over to it for 130 minutes, because otherwise it may not work for you.
Patches, you want to talk about Mudbound? What do you think?
Yeah, I mean, I was quite moved by it at Sundance, but I totally agree with David that, I mean, I was talking to you and Joanna about this movie off podcast, Katie, and I don't know, I don't want to speak for Joanna here, but the sentiment I got was that seeing it on Netflix just may have been suffocating for such an expansive story. But I still think that the performances would come through. Again, I don't know if this is a family movie. You know, there's a lot it is about families, but it's not heartwarming holiday fare by any means. It's a lot to chew on. The conflict between this white, not rich. I mean, they have a little bit of money, but they move away to this farm where they're living with black help on the farm, and they try and get along, but they can't because of the circumstances. And then World War II happens, and there's just so much chaos imploding the relationships that they're trying to build and struggling to hold on to. And of course, the old racist dad, what's his name from Breaking Bad? Oh, he just turns
Jonathan
up so
Banks.
Much trouble. Yeah, Jonathan Banks.
Yeah, I don't know. It's hard because you look at a character like that, and you're like, of course, there were so many people and men like this, and still are, who are just unrepentant, virulent racists. They do not have any part of them.
And it plays like a caricature for you?
Yeah, that tells them to withdraw. And maybe this is my the good fortune that I had in growing up in a time where, I mean, yeah, yay for racism being institutional and invisible rather than so out in the open, I guess. I don't know. But I think it's just, it does feel like a caricature to me. And I know that that's probably unfair.
I don't know. I mean, to get deep into Mudbound, I think the idea of what's interesting about it, telling a story like this, is not that you're just kind of hammering home the kinds of racists that we imagine, like being Klansmen or whatever, but kind of getting into the other shapes that it takes. And you have a character like Jason Clarks, who's like not especially racist, but not racist, and isn't like there to break down any of the barriers that exist in the society.
Well, he's a product
like
of
that,
the system, right? He just racism, so he's racist.
Yeah, and it's not asking you to have sympathy for him. It's just kind of asking you to see them as people and less of kind of the caricatures that I think made it easy for us to imagine that this kind of thing was over. It's like, well, we don't have people who are like Jonathan Banks anymore, so racism is dead.
I get really swept up in Mudbound's kind of novelistic qualities, where we kind of drift from perspective to perspective. You know, there's different voiceover. We're seeing Carey Mulligan is the wife dragged to this horrible life that she's not taken seriously by her husband, Jason Clark, who wants to make a better life for for the family. And he has good intentions, but it's not working out. But he's a stubborn man, and it's his duty to save this family. So there's those there's the gender dynamics. And then you have the black family that's living on the farm and helping. And they're trying to make do because, you know, the dad falls off what does he fall off of? Ladder?
He's building. Yeah, he falls off a ladder.
Yeah, and then that you know, ruins the family. The one mistake, like if the dad can't provide, what is the family going to do? And then you have Jason Mitchell from Straight Outta Compton, who I love in this movie.
He is so good.
He's really good, and he comes back from the war, trying to get his life started again, and he starts palling around with Garrett Hedlund, who plays Carey Mulligan's brother, who is a do-nothing,
brother-in-law.
A drunk brother-in-law.
He's Jason Clark's brother.
Jason Clark's brother, okay. Yeah, see, there's a lot of characters, but that's why I really loved spending time in this world and just, like, seeing all the pockets and the relationships here. But their dynamic is the most interesting because Garrett Hedlund is also a war vet, and they bond, you know. They don't think about race in their post-war mentality, and as they both suffer from PTSD, as they both drink their nightmares away, as they both try and figure out how to come back to this crazy world that they exist in. That is so profound to me, and the courses they go off on, and where Jason Mitchell ends up. I definitely won't spoil anything about his story, but like the things he encounters are horrific, and the life that he tries to carve out in the end after World War II is just like it's a real challenge, and you feel the weight of it on his shoulders. It's, you know, a lot of movies can pretend to have that drama or can write it down on paper, but not a lot of them feel that lived in.
Yeah, it's there's a decision at the end of this movie that Jason Mitchell's character has to make, which the particulars of which escape me, kind of, from Sundance. The stakes do not. But
there's a life lived overseas during World War II that he can, you know, is going back.
There's a decision at the very end that I will not hint at more than say that I was confused by the outcome. That really sort of took the wind out of the sails of the ending for me. I mean, all I could think about were these really morbid details of this one thing and not sort of the emotional pull of everything that was happening. I'm not totally sold on this movie, but I do think that it's there's a lot going on. It is very, very much worth seeing. And there's obviously a lower bar for recommending things when they are available on Netflix. But Mudbound, Dee Reese, I think, has the potential to be a major filmmaker, and there are major performances in this, and I do think that what Patches was saying about the novelistic structure of it, you know, it being adapted from a novel, it's nice that novelistic is an adjective you can apply to the film as well. She pulls it off beautifully in how all these stories flow into one another, even if it didn't always keep me engaged. But
yeah,
it's definitely
worth
checking out. You'll know what I mean about that ending when you get there, though.
Well, we'll talk about it later. It kind of reminds me of Angelina Jolie's movie, First They Killed My Father. Not really that the movies are anything alike, except that they're both like beautifully filmed, kind of expansive and difficult
watches. You think that movie's beautifully filmed?
Which one?
First They Killed My Father?
Yeah, you don't think so?
No.
Oh, all right. Well,
I think it's digital bluff.
All right, sidebar to what I was saying is that they are large movies that are both available on Netflix and you kind of have to really invest yourself in. And I don't know, I kind of feel like the best way to watch any movie on Netflix, or maybe any movie period, is by yourself, which is how I've been watching a lot of movies lately. So maybe that's like the part of Thanksgiving where everyone else has already gone to bed and you feel up for a 2.5 hour epic about sharecroppers.
Yeah, that's like that Milagro Beanfield movie that I had to watch like 20 times growing up. It's about farmers.
I have no idea what you're talking about.
I'm going to Google it because I swear I'm not making up a movie. It is 1988, the Milagro Beanfield War. It's the story about the American Southwest. It's a farming irrigation drama. Unimportant that I had to watch it a lot. Actually, you know what, guys? If you want something to watch with your family, there is nothing less offensive than the Milagro Beanfield War of 1998.
I was actually going to recommend, speaking of Netflix originals, and we've talked about this movie a lot, so we don't need to go into details, but I do think The Meyerowitz Stories is maybe a good movie to watch with multiple generations of family who, you know, you have to have everyone ready for a little bit of discomfort, but I liked that movie, and it seems like it could hit a lot of... you could get people interested. Tell them that Adam Sandler and Ben Stiller and Dustin Hoffman are in it, and once you've lured them in that way, they might stick around.
Are there any movies about families that where the families aren't, like, totally neurotic or... questioning their past and things that
certainly
would actually bring a family together?
Back.
Yeah, no.
Are we talking about like new or just easily accessible
new
movies?
I mean, is there any hope and warm fuzzy
feelings?
Isn't
Wonder supposed to be pretty good?
Wonder is only in theaters, but it is. Yeah. I had to go see that for work, and it is. It is definitely tolerable. It's good for young kids. It's Jacob Tremblay plays
a
kid.
My boy.
Like, you know, 21st century Rocky Dennis as a facial disfigurement. Nothing much less. I mean, it's the prosthetic that they put over him. It's almost designed for maximum adorability. His eyes are downturned in just the right way to make it seem like he's wincing for your empathy at all times.
He's grumpy cat,
just about, like,
basically.
You're in the life of him at school as he starts middle school, as opposed to being homeschooled. His parents are Julia Roberts and Owen Wilson. But what is great about this movie, and what it ports from its novel as well, very similar to Mudbound in this respect, is its shifting perspectives. After like 30 minutes, pretty much what it does is every time you think another character is being selfish, every time it entreats you into thinking that a character is behaving selfishly, were judging our little hero, the movie stops and it switches perspectives to that person and brings you into their life and shows you that they have their own shit going on. And by the end of the movie, Jake Tremblay's character is less the protagonist than he is sort of this focal point around which all these characters orbit. You understand they are all looking for empathy for one another, and that all sort of he becomes this catalyst for them to find it. David Diggs is in it as Jacob's teacher, continuing the Hamiltonification of movies, which I'm not going to complain about. It's great.
Not just Hamilton is a musical.
Yeah,
that has people in it.
It's a very famous musical.
I don't know what you're talking about.
It was it was a few years ago, but it's good. And they have it's by the guy who did Perks of Being a Wallflower, Stephen Chomsky, whatever.
Sure.
If you have kids in your family, whatever, great. Great to see.
See?
Totally painless until it goes on like a hard 20 minutes too long. Like I was clawing at the end, but solid stuff.
See, all right, so that's in theaters. A lot of other stuff in theaters. No one should go
see
Justice League established.
Yeah, if we don't want to talk about only Netflix, not only does Hulu have the not Daniel Craig James Bond films right now, which are great for family watching, but they're about to debut The Runaways, which is actually a good Marvel series, unlike, say, The Punisher, which is now on Netflix, which is a lukewarm to poor Marvel series. So if you like the creators of Gossip Girl taking on a Brian K. Vaughan written comic book adaptation about some kids living on the West Coast who figure out that their parents are supervillains and are forced to be friends again, and it turns out they have superpowers from like talking to a raptor to like, you know, maybe having some magic, The Runaways will be a super great superhero series, as opposed to one that makes you deal with gun violence.
But let's set expectations correctly. It is definitely more of a Josh Schwartz show than it is a Brian K. Vaughan show. It's very like OC Gossip Girl.
Wait, I have a very important
announcement.
I said
Gossip Girl creators.
I have a very important announcement to make that is more important than anything you could possibly be saying.
Thanks,
this
David.
Is more of a... No problem. You're talking about something like the run Marvel anything. This is more important. And you'll understand why. In a few weeks, and this is actually, sadly, a little bit after Thanksgiving, but you can currently go on Amazon Prime and watch the pilot before the first season is uploaded. I just can't even believe this is real at this point. Someone named Amy Sherman-Palladino took Gossip Girl, fuck everything, took Gilmore Girls and combined it with Mad Men. And made it into one show with a nice paprika, a little dabble on top of extreme Jewishness. Now, if you ask me, David, if you could design a show from scratch to be the ultimate television show, what would it be? I would say Gilmore Girls plus Mad Men with a heavy layer of
Now, have you actually seen any of it?
I don't know if I need the Jewishness personally. I live enough with that in my own life. I have seen the first two episodes of the show. It is staggeringly good.
It's called The Marvelous Mrs. Maisel, for those of you keeping
Maisel.
Track.
It stars Rachel Brosnahan, Brosnahan. There will become a time in my life very soon where I am like incensed at anyone mispronouncing this wonderful woman's name. But it is it's a show about a woman who is I'll be quick about this so we can get back to the real art form of cinema. But it's a show about a woman who's played by Rachel Brosnahan. And she is like a beautiful young housewife, and she's happy being a husband. So happy being a wife to her husband, who is a Mad Men type, who's gotten a cushy job. And they have two kids, and he wants to be a stand-up. And then he leaves her and for his secretary, and then she winds up becoming a stand-up, and this all happens in the pilot, and it is phenomenal. So look out for that. Do some pilot shopping if you're home for the holidays. You could not do better than The Marvelous Mrs. Maisel.
I watched the pilot. It's great. The show, I guess the full show isn't available until December, but I definitely would recommend people catch up with it.
The end of November.
Okay. All right. Soon enough. All right. Everything else in theaters. I don't know if you would go see Call Me By Your Name with your family, but it'll be there. Maybe it's something you go see with your cool friends when you're done with your family. I don't know. There's just sex in it. I don't know how comfortable you feel about watching sex with your family in a movie theater.
Was that a question?
I don't know. Yeah, I mean, I guess it's a personal decision for everyone to make.
The older I get, the easier it is to be in the same theater as my parents and sex on a screen.
Mm. Good.
Younger, it was like, I don't want them elbowing me, being like, huh? Because that's how my parents would deal with it.
And then also Lady Bird is going to be in more theaters. I think
yes. It's
like, it's not in like Aiken, South Carolina, so it's not everywhere. It's not like Justice League everywhere, but it's probably in a lot of major cities.
Can we
dribbling out? I was at
is like the surest bet to take your family to.
Yeah, I think we've basically been leading up to go take your family to see Lady Bird.
I got a pin. I was one of the youngest people in the theater of the first showing, and then as I left, lining up for like the next showing were my age group of people. I just went to the too early of a show, but it's for everybody. It's great. You'll call your parents afterwards. I didn't get to say this last week, so I'm saying it now. Lady Bird, it was good. I also liked it.
I'm almost afraid to see it with my mom, which I probably will at some point, because I feel like it's going to have like too many truths.
Mm.
But I'll report back. Other people must be having this problem too.
Those are tough movies. What was the Tree of Life? Watching Tree of Life with my dad ended up being,
oh god,
semi-emotional. But yeah, anyway, you make your good Thanksgiving decisions, people. The important thing is you don't have to change your relatives you hate when there's good entertainment to not have that conversation by.
I didn't even get to the Barbra Streisand special. That's how much there was to talk about. That does it for this week's Fighting in the War Room. We'll be back next week. In the meantime, tell the people who you are.
I'm Matt Patches. I'm the executive entertainment editor of Thrillist.com, and I am on Twitter at Mr. Patches, and we have a website, fightinginthewarroom.com, where you can listen to episodes, you can share them with your friends, you can leave comments that we can read at length. If you can't reach us on the iTunes reviews for some reason, you can always reach us there with urgent inquiries. It's fightinginthewarroom.com.
David Ehrlich, I'm
sitting
critic for IndieWire. You can find me on Twitter at David Ehrlich. You can find me IndieWire. You can follow and find all of us together. I don't know what happened there. I just malfunctioned.
Westworld Season 2.
Yes, coming soon. You can find all of us together on Facebook at Fighting in the War Room. If you live abroad and would like to leave us a review or get in touch with us and are afraid that we won't see your review on an international iTunes store, Facebook is a great way to get in touch.
And I'm Dave Gonzalez. You can find me on Twitter at DA7E, where I will pin some of my Justice League work for Thrillist.com. In case you haven't gotten enough of that movie, I wrote a lot about it. And last week's Storm of Spoilers was almost as long as the movie itself, including over an hour of just being like, what about that sequence? What were they thinking? How did this come to be? In case that's your bag. If not, we're going to debate the best superhero and supervillain performances this week in our second Great Debates. Check it out, Storm is Blows.
I'm Katie Rich. You can find me at vanityfair.com and on the podcast there, Little Gold Men, where we're also talking about performances that you might want to catch. So many recommendations. You can find me on Twitter at Katie Rich, KATEYRICH. And we're all on Twitter at FITWR, where we love to hear from you, hear what you're seeing with your family over Thanksgiving, or you can answer this week's lightning round question, which was,
in honor of the darkest hour, what's the worst movie makeup?
Thanks for listening, and we'll be back talking to you next week.
up your skirt a little more.